Welcome to the GoTo Podcast. In this episode, two physicists and one mathematician take part in a fireside chat about how math has an impact on every single part of our lives. GoTo gathers the brightest minds in the software community to help developers tackle projects today, plan for tomorrow, and create a better future. Stay up to date with the latest in tech through GoTo's top-rated events held online and in person in cities like Amsterdam, London, Copenhagen, and Chicago, and by subscribing to the GoTo Conferences YouTube channel, where you can find thousands more high-quality dev talks. Learn more at gotopia.tech.
Let me just start by saying thank you very much. Your talk's absolutely wonderful. Let's pretend this is actually TV. What's your favourite equation?
So I should say to me, I'm not a mathematician. So my degree was in physics.
And so you're opting out of the first question.
No. But just
I think I believe that. I do have a degree in physics, and there are equations in physics.
Yeah.
I'm very sure of that. It was a long time ago.
You mentioned we have mathematicians on stage, and I just want to say mathematician singular, and then somebody kind of writes about math from time to time. And I think I think Euler's identity is the one, isn't it? It's
quite pretty.
They had a poll. Actually, was polled in the Institute of Physics for the favourite equation amongst physicists, and that came first. And I think E equals MC squared was second, and actually, no, maybe Maxwell's equations were second.
Thing is, I think Euler's equation is a bit like the pumpkin spice latte of the maths world, right? It's like it's like the one that everyone says, the one that everyone loves to love, and then I love to hate, right? I think that's so I'm going to go for instead. I'm going to go for the Navier-Stokes equations. Now, so these are the equations that describe how fluids move. So that's fluid, but it includes gases, right?
Yeah.
Because there's very little difference, obviously, in a mathematical world between fluids and gases, just a question of viscosity. But the thing about these equations is you can write them in two lines on an A4 sheet of paper, and they will tell you everything from how a tiny little drop of dew on a leaf will move to everything, to the formation of a galaxy in the sky. And I just think the level, there's nothing I've ever seen is as articulate as those equations at being able to describe the universe. I just think they're extraordinarily beautiful.
So that's a kind of that's a couple of really interesting ones. First of all, Euler's identity is more likely to end up as a piece of graffiti than anything else. In fact, I can actually tell you I live in Bristol, and I can tell you that there's about 10 minutes walk from my house, Bath Buildings. It's graffitied there. I posted that last year. And people go like, wow, you live in a really good area, Kevin. So that's very respectable. But I think the thing about the Navier-Stokes, you're quite right, but if I remember correctly, isn't that one of the seven, Clay Mathematical Institute, isn't that one of their seven millennium problems?
It is, yeah. First off, I need to get a spray can and start tagging Navier-Stokes equations around London.
Navier-Stokes.
Yes, it is. So this is around the turn of the millennium where the Clay Maths Institute decided to come up with a list of the seven greatest unsolved problems in mathematics. And one of them, as you rightly say, is the Navier-Stokes equations. Because we have these equations, you can write them down and you can solve them in special cases. Throw away a dimension or two and suddenly they become much easier. But in pretty much every situation, you can use a computer to kind of crunch through and work out what numbers work inside the equations. But nobody has ever proved that you can always solve it. So if you can prove that there is the existence and smoothness of a solution to these equations that in every domain, in every regime, then you win £1 million.
Okay.
It's quite hard, though, I should say. It's quite hard.
Yeah, let's just put that into perspective. Let's see, they were set in 2004. That's seven challenges. One has been solved. Grigori Perelman, who famously refused the reward money. And also then you actually feature him in your book. I remember when that played out. It's just like, he's, you know, he's the ultimate eccentric in this case, and refused the Fields Medal as well.
Yeah, I mean, if I remember rightly, he solved the Poincaré conjecture. And when he sort of wasn't attached to a university, he was kind of a bit of a rogue mathematician. I'm sure Simon probably knows this story better than I do, but this proof emerged on the scene, and everybody in the world was like, where did this come from? And then over time, agreed that he had indeed solved this really important problem in mathematics. But the award ceremony, I think, I can't remember whether it was for the Fields Medal or the million pound prize, was in Barcelona. And he reasoned that to collect the award, to collect all the money, he would have to spend a day travelling from where he lived in Moscow to Barcelona, a day collecting the prize, and then a day returning home. And that was 3 days when he wouldn't be doing mathematics, so it wasn't worth it.
I mean, how hardcore is that? Okay, just like that is out. But there's also another thing there which I find kind of interesting. Now you're stoked. So I came across that once upon a physics degree, and it's just like physics. Yeah, you can calculate with it. You know, you just knock off those extra dimensions. You take those special cases and leave the rest for the mathematicians. Like in physics, we can compute with it. And then I went to computing. It's just like, honestly, we just throw stuff in it until you know it sits on the wall and until somebody complains about it, and you say, oh, we'll just tweak the UX, and that's it. Sorry, everybody who's a programmer out there, I've just revealed your secrets. But you know, so there's a really interesting point, because Simon, in your presentation earlier, you made a point about this kind of this. It's not so much a burden of proof, but the fact that a proof is everlasting in that sense. There is a timeless sense. Once somebody said this theorem, it's done. That's it. Attach a name to it. We're good. And that there's no recourse to negating it.
Beautiful architecture of mathematics where people build their ideas. I mean, you do have this situation where people have a conjecture and they're pretty confident that it's true. And so you build on top of it and you just hope and pray that that conjecture will one day be locked into place with its own proof. But if it's not, then this whole other area of math just tumbles down.
Yeah. And it's like, given this, assuming that this works out, then we have that. And that was actually the one of the points in Fermat, the Taniyama Shimura conjecture, which was 1950s.
Yeah, yeah. So I mean, that's so we didn't get onto the proof, but so Wiles was plugging away at this proof, from time to time. I mean, I should say, by the time he became an undergraduate, he became a PhD student, he became a lecturer and then a professor. He worked on other things. You know, he had to publish papers. He had to do some kind of serious mainstream work. You couldn't build a career out of trying to prove something that was considered impossible. But then there was this link to the Taniyama-Shimura conjecture. And the Taniyama-Shimura conjecture was developed by Yutaka Taniyama and Goro Shimura in Japan, two kind of young maverick kids, really, who believed that they could build a bridge between two very different areas of mathematics. The way I kind of explain it is, it's as though you've got electricity here and magnetism here, and you build this theory of electrodynamics to kind of electromagnetism to bridge these two subjects and show that they're really kind of reflections of each other. And they tried to do the same in mathematics, but it was a conjecture. They couldn't prove it. And it was shown that if the if Fermat's last theorem was correct, no, let me take it the other way. Gosh, this is confusing now. If Fermat's last theorem was false, if it's false, then there is an equation where x to the n plus y to the n is z to the n. There are numbers that fit that equation. There's an x, a y, a z, and there's an n, and it all fits beautifully. Now, if there is a counterexample, let's take those four numbers and let's plug them into the Taniyama-Shimura conjecture. Let's make an elliptic curve, which is what Taniyama-Shimura is all about. If you make this elliptic curve, it falsifies Taniyama-Shimura, and Taniyama-Shimura then falls apart. Conversely, if you can prove that Taniyama-Shimura is correct, if it's largely true, then these numbers can't exist in Fermat's last theorem. And if they can't exist in Fermat's last theorem, then Fermat's last theorem is true. So suddenly there was this link between a 350-year-old problem that people had sort of given up hope on. There was a link between that and something relatively modern and fundamentally important to the heart of mathematics. So that's when Wiles returned to it, because he thought, well, look, if I dedicate myself to trying to prove Taniyama-Shimura, I'm doing mainstream mathematics. I'm doing something that's worthwhile. And even if I can't prove it, I might develop interesting ideas, interesting insights, interesting tools. And he didn't tell anybody what he was doing because proving Fermat's Last Theorem was crazy. Trying to prove Taneyama-Shamir was pretty much impossible as well. People had given up on that. So he didn't tell anybody what he was doing. He really kind of locked himself away. And he didn't want people to think he was crazy. He didn't want people to badger him with questions all the time. How's it going? How's it going? He didn't want other people to maybe join the chase. But what the clever thing he did for an academic point of view was that just prior to embarking on this attempted proof of Taneyama-Shimura, he had a stack of papers he hadn't quite published and they were waiting to be sent out to different journals. So he would he'd send them out to journals every year or two, a different paper, so that everybody thought that's what he's working on. But in fact, that was old work he'd done a while ago. Now he was working full steam on Taneyama-Shimura in order to get to Fermat's Last Theorem.
So that's career advice, just in case anybody is thinking about doing that. It's you know, if you have this really good thing, and you know, I'm going to just reframe in a software thing. One thing I told the client one day, they'd spent 2-3 years improving the performance of their application by 25%, and then we did, I stumbled across a 200% improvement. And I said, "Do not release this all at once." You know, it's just like, you know, and that. So there's some really good career advice in here.
Simon, can you say the story about Taneyama-Shimura's approach to problems and failure? Because it's honestly the most beautiful thing.
Yeah. So Taneyama sadly took his own life when he was very young. I think he was in his late 20s. He was a very young chap, and nobody understands why this happened. He was in love. He was, you know, his career in mathematics was going very well. He took his own life, and his best friend Goro Shimura was completely baffled by this. And so I interviewed him many years later, and he was telling me about Taneyama as a friend, but also Taneyama as a mathematician. And he said, you know, the great thing about Taneyama was that when he was doing mathematics, he would make mistakes, but the mistakes would somehow illuminate new areas of maths and new insights that would lead to new breakthroughs in their work. And he said he tried to copy Taneyama in making mistakes like this. And he said, you know, but you know, it's really hard to make good mistakes.
This whole idea, again, I think that there's this beautiful balance between the two of them. Is this idea of one is perhaps more methodical in his approach, and there's this counterbalance of somebody who really is, you know, very, very different. And you've got to learn to make good mistakes. And that turns out to be quite an art.
Yes.
But there's also this fascinating idea of that there's an immense amount of creativity. I think this is one of the things I think is often underestimated in maths, and perhaps the route that people take through education is the amount of creativity that's involved in coming up with, you know, reaching certain conclusions. And often there's a twist, there's a surprise, or something, you know, something that is potentially either humorous or the light bulbs go on. Obviously, these are eco-friendly light bulbs these days, but, you know, they're kind of like, but they go on, and suddenly there's this thing. But some of it comes about through this idea of sort of play or very, very lateral thinking or looking at something very unusual. And I think that that's the thing I always find fascinating about mathematicians. It's like, here's this really hard problem over here. Here's another one. And they're kind of, I'll do this one. This one's more interesting. Now, that's sort of a classic distraction technique. And yet it turns out to be the basis of a whole discipline.
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Should I be excited or afraid of AI? The answer is yes, it's both.
Things are going to look so different in the next couple years. You will not be ready for the disruptions that are going to come.
I'm Jeff Nielsen, host of Digital Disruption, the go-to podcast for technology leaders.
Our generation's conflict, I think, is going to be emotional, not economic.
The companies that are going to win are the ones that have a couple of characteristics.
Stay ahead of the curve with Digital Disruption, available now on your favorite podcast platform.
I think that's right, although I also think that once you're in that hard problem, then you say, okay, let's throw away absolutely everything and imagine what happens in the case where n equals 1, right? Like, simplify it so that it's ridiculous. Yeah. So, for instance, during my PhD, which was on the Navier-Stokes equation, after 4 years, I'll tell you how far we got, I managed to get to it. So it was all about how a droplet moved along a plane. And after 4 years, I managed to get a two-dimensional model that didn't include gravity or surface tension. So, I mean, don't think that we're...
So to be continued.
Exactly. Exactly.
So I think there's this approach of abstraction. It's just like, let's eliminate that. And in physics, you were talking about the spherical bastard thing. And in physics, there's a very common thing of, well, let's just treat this as a sphere. If cows were spherical, then yes, that is actually a real statement from a paper. Let's just assume that cows are spherical, and therefore, there's all kinds of conclusions that you can reach there, which is so. Spheres are beloved of mathematicians, and it turns out physicists as well. They have this kind of obsession with things, and they also have a mild obsession with donuts. And it turns out that one is not the same as the other. Except if you buy donuts from certain stores, they are sort of equivalent to the other kind of donuts. So this is kind of really interesting thing about this abstraction, this whole idea about you've got a whole branch of mathematics devoted to the idea that that this is in fact a this is a sphere. Actually, it's a plane. I can make it a sphere.
You can make it a sphere.
Yeah. That's good.
Or a plate.
A plate. In fact, I can turn it into a working one of these. There's lots of possibilities.
But I think humans are donuts, aren't we?
But it depends. It depends. Because it's certainly true that in evolutionary terms, I spoke about this with a biologist. In fact, Adam Rutherford, my co-conspirator, as you described him, and almost all biological life is based on the idea of a tube. But if you get really technical about humans, then you also have holes in your eyes, right? Like tear ducts. Yeah. So I think that we worked it out that we're seven-holed donuts.
Okay.
Does anyone have any idea what we're talking about? It seems like we've just jumped into a different dimension.
Should we rewind here? Because topology and topologists never ask a topologist to help you lay out the house. Okay, you leave that to the geometers. Okay, geometers know where everything is and they can say various things. Whereas topologists abstract this idea, and it's known as rubber sheet.
Mm-hmm. Topologists are the kind of people who say that if I wear my pants inside out, they contain the whole universe.
Exactly.
That kind of thing.
So we're learning some things there. So we've got this whole idea that if I can reshape without cutting, that's the whole thing.
Or punching any holes in it.
Or punching any holes. Then I can show that one form is equivalent to another. As long as I can reshape, stretch, it's stretching, everything's really good. And, we can flatten this one down without doing anything into a plate, but not until I've finished. And it turns out that there are a number of things that are donuts, and we mean the disappointingly not jam-filled ones, the donuts. So a torus, that is a cup. So therefore, never ask a topologist for a cup of tea. That somebody's going to get wet and hot. So you've got this. And it also turns out that is topologically equivalent to an asteroids screen. Have you ever played asteroids? If not, what have you done with your life? We've had the whole retro gaming phase at least two or three times since the 80s. And so there's this idea that these forms are equivalent. So as long as you can stretch it. So that's one hole. But you're saying humans come down to, we're seven-hole donuts.
Yeah, I spent quite a lot of time thinking about this at one point, and now I can't remember any of it. But so certainly tear ducts. So there's like one there, one there, but that only gets to
ears.
So ears don't work because if you imagine you've got a bit of plasticine and then you poke a hole in it, that's like an ear, and then you can remold it so it's out. So that's fine. So I think that maybe because your nose connects up to the same tube, maybe that's one. And then, I don't know, maybe other people can work it out. Yeah, what else is there?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Your nose has two holes.
Yeah, but then don't they join at the top? I mean, this is the very limits of what I know about biology. What does your nose do up here?
So I think we're learning here about some important things about how math's really done. So we've got all this
you're a proper mathematician and you sometimes write about maths. But you also, and I'm not a proper mathematician, if I'm not a proper anything, right? So I'm always outside of my comfort zone, writing about cosmology or cryptography and so on. And I really enjoy that process of learning about something that's completely new. Whereas half of your work is within your comfort zone, I kind of feel, and half of it is out. Mm-hmm. How does that play? Which do you prefer?
Yeah, although I think that the key thing is teaming up with somebody like Adam, who is at the opposite end of a spectrum to me.
Yeah.
Because then I've got maths and physics pretty much covered. I mean, I'm not an expert, I'm not a physicist, but there's very little in physics that I can that I can't read and, you know, understand. So yeah. Math, physics and computer science, I'm down that end. He's got kind of biology and genetics. And we meet in the middle where neither of us know anything about chemistry. Mm.
That's, I was going to say, I'm sensing there's something we missed out here. And it's just like, oh, it's poor old chemistry. So apologies to the chemists out there. But that, so you're an improper mathematician. I'm going to use it because you just referred to Hannah as a proper mathematician. Yeah. And I like to make this kind of like complete kind of...
But I think there's a difference between, you know, people like Sir Martin Rees, who is an astrophysicist and who writes brilliant books about astrophysics, or Steve Jones, who writes brilliant books about... And yourself and Adam, who also write your own books about those specialised topics. And it's fun for me just to kind of go out and explore and find different things and almost do a degree. Because, you know, it's been 3 years just immersed in a topic. But I've also co-authored a book once with... so he was a professor. Professor Edzard Ernst was a professor of complementary medicine. It wasn't on my list of books that I'd written. I don't know why I'd omitted it. But he was very much the academic. And what his position was that he'd done all this research on alternative therapies and what doesn't work and what does work. And he was, so he was very much the font of all knowledge. But there was this nice relationship where I could challenge him and say, well, look, I don't understand that, or why is that true, or who's checked this out, or what does that study mean? And he could interpret all the papers and I could challenge him and try and then interpret it. But I enjoyed being a co-author. I thought it worked well.
Did you clash, though, on what was interesting? Because I think the one thing about Fermi's Last Theorem, I don't think I've ever told you this, Simon, but I read that book when I was like 15, and it was... I mean, I know that, like, I can't imagine the thousands of people who've told you this.
No, it just makes Fermi's you feel really old.
Really was the book for me, right? It was like the book that made me decide I wanted to be a mathematician. And the thing about it is that you've got a real knack of finding the stories that are incredibly intriguing without getting bogged down in the detail. And I wonder, when you worked with an academic who cares totally about the detail, did you clash on what to include?
First of all, thank you very much. Thank you. Authors love hearing that. And you must know that as well. So I think he said, look, you know, you're the author, you do the writing. And in terms of the material, it's a very different book from my other books. My other books, you know, I would say, right, cosmology, there are fantastic stories here. And, you know, I can pick the best stories in cosmology and put them together somehow. And some of the more boring stuff or irrelevant stuff, it's not an authoritative history of cosmology. It's my own version of the stuff I find most interesting. And the same with cryptography. You know, there were some areas of cryptography that I didn't write about because I just didn't think they were that interesting, but I could pick my own pathway through. And Fermat is terrific because all the stories are fantastic and they all fit together so beautifully. And Fermat touched on so many different areas of maths that you can talk about whatever you want. But with alternative medicine, it's the challenge was, this is a book that will tell you what works and what doesn't work. So how do you take that topic, which could be quite dry, it could just be a list of... here's therapy A, here's condition B, what's the evidence? And so the challenge was to spice that up somehow. And there are stories that spice that up. Sometimes they're tragic stories. Sometimes they're stories from history. So that was the challenge. But we didn't really clash. I think the clash was my naivety as a physicist, where if you accumulate enough data, you'll know whether it's true or not. Working with a doctor who says, well, you know what? It's a bit fuzzier in medicine because every human is different and every dose is different and every condition is different and so on. So it took me a long time to understand that this was not going to be, there weren't going to be clear-cut conclusions every time.
So that's an interesting point about the collaboration and pulling in different directions. And you were highlighting your work with Adam. And disciplinary-wise, you're in different spaces. But actually, reading through the book, but also, I mean, you know, it's easy to hear the voices when we listen to the radio show, but reading through the book, you can kind of sense, and every now and then there's like a Hannah bit.
Do you think you can tell?
There's the bits you say, but there are actually a couple of bits where I can
really?
Tell. Yes.
Interesting.
We'll compare answers later. I've co-authored a couple of books, and it is kind of interesting. Every now and then I can go back and say, I know exactly who wrote that and who wrote that first, second, third, or this chapter is actually mine. The other guy's just you know, changed the punctuation and then I changed it back, or, you know, or in fact, I did work with an academic and he put lots of references in. I'm industry, so I took half the references out. He would query references. I actually had to say at one point, actually, that was a conversation with my wife I'm referring to. So that was the kitchen table, but I don't think that qualifies. But he, Doug was just like, yeah, he's all, but even when you smoothed it out, there are some differences. But there are bits where also there's an interplay. I mean, we know about the music taste differences. That comes through quite a lot. And the film, some of the film differences, sure, as well. You know, that, those are made explicit. But there's also some very nice counterbalance there as well. And, you know, it's you're stuck together for 18 series. So, you know, clearly something works there. But how do you find that that affects your thinking or your outlook or your approach? You kind of look at, you say, right, I'm going to come to the table with this, and Adam's going to kind of, you know,
add to it or the other way around.
Add to it, or, you know, turn it around or offer something I wasn't aware of, or just simply agree because that this is actually the whole story.
That is a really good question. Okay, so I think that Adam and I are not just opposite in terms of where we are on the spectrum of science. I think we are opposite in almost absolutely everything. So I was thinking about your Tanya Amashimura story earlier. I think, like, I am just very highly strung, very meticulous, always do my homework, really, I mean, like, prepare, right? And Adam waltzes in at the last moment and just is amazing, right? And it's very annoying to me that is what he's like. But with this book, I think what the real, like, genesis of it was actually that because both of us know different things, and we're very, very good friends, and we often just send each other messages when we come across stories that we think that will make the other one laugh, or we'll think the other one will find interesting, not for kind of broadcast, not for publication, nothing, but just we had this, like, whole bank of stories. And then we decided we wanted to put them in a book. And Adam was like, well, let's just put them in a book. But then I was like, no, this book needs to be ambitious. I want to talk about free will. I want to talk about Umwelt. I want to talk about infinity. I want to talk about four-dimensional spheres. So it was me sort of pulling it in that direction and then him adding in all of that joy.
Yeah. And you did get all of those topics covered. It did not look like a series of text messages.
No,
you
know, it did not.
So, you know, I want to write a book about everything.
It would have been a much quicker book. It wouldn't have taken us 3 years if we just published
this. Just copy and paste this all in. Yeah, it's just, I mean, that's honestly how software development's done. So, you know, but we call it, we use different systems. We use stronger
Slack.
We put it on. If it's on Slack, then it's real. You know, if I pushed it to Git, whatever. You know, so there's a whole idea. So there's a shaping process. So you consider that. So there's a kind of a balance there in that sense. And that it reminds me of the collaboration you were just talking about in terms of the Tony Amashimura. This is idea of, like, okay, here's an idea, and then there's okay, let's kind of do something and create a shape there.
I mean, I think that's the thing about Andrew Wiles's story. It is, you know, one mathematician working in solitary confinement for 7 years.
He's the outlier, isn't he?
Yeah, and I hope, you know, young mathematicians or you know, people get the impression that actually, you know, there's a richer context for mathematics in a lot of it. So I remember going to the Newton Institute in Cambridge, which was this institute, it must be 25 years old now, but, you know, here was a building that was dedicated to bringing mathematicians from around the world to brainstorm subjects in 6 month sections, and then 6 months later you'd have a different topic and a different group of mathematicians coming in, and it was specially designed. There are no corridors because they didn't want mathematicians to hide away anywhere. Everything was designed so that mathematicians would be continually bumping into each other and collaborating and chatting and so on, and that's really what the majority of mathematics is about. It's the way the majority of society works and the way the majority of breakthroughs take place. But yeah, I think
they've got chalkboards in the ladies' loos at the Newton Institute.
Okay, that's proper.
And the gents' loos.
Is it? I've never been in the gents' loo.
So there is this interesting thing about this idea that you've got this kind of spectrum, this wave in terms of degrees of collaboration. And it's just like Andrew Wiles is an outlier in the modern mathematics sense.
So do you know about polymath?
Go on, what do you mean?
So polymath, I think, is a blog by Tim Gowers.
Oh, yes, I do know what you mean, yeah.
So Tim Gowers is one of these field medalists. Yeah. Oh, yes, I do. Just for people that know, there's no Nobel Prize in maths, but there is the Fields Medal that gets given every 4 years. I think you have to be under 40. But Tim Gowers has one of these Fields Medals, one of the great, great British mathematicians. And he created this blog where he would post a problem and people would add comments Yeah, they'd add their contribution in the comments section. And they've solved a few problems, mm-hmm. and they published the papers, and everybody who's added a comment gets to be a co-author on the paper, mm-hmm. I think. So that's at the very other extreme end of, you know, global collaboration.
And likewise, we see that a lot in experimental science. I mean, CERN is the kind of classic, mm-hmm. you know, it's just like a thousand authors mm-hmm. type thing.
And even Andrew, I don't mean to, again, Andrew Wiles, so we should finish the story. So 7 years he worked on this problem and eventually felt he had a complete proof and went back to Cambridge, the town where he grew up, and gave a lecture, I think a series of three lectures, gradually revealing this proof, never ever saying what this was, where this was going to lead to. Although I think by the third lecture, people were beginning to sense where this was going to go. It was going to be a sufficient proof of Taniyama Shimura to lead to Fermat's Last Theorem. And the lecture theatre was packed at the Newton Institute. And he revealed the final line and said, I think I'll stop there. And you know, a huge round of applause broke out and cheering. And he was in newspapers around the world the next day. You know mathematician solves 350-year-old riddle. It was a math story of the century. And then it turned out that... then it had to be published, it had to be refereed. And this was a 200-page proof in seven chapters. So it was sent off to seven pairs of referees. And in one chapter, in one page, in one paragraph, there was a problem. And it couldn't easily be resolved. There were lots of problems, and they could generally be fixed quite easily, but not this one problem. And Andrew Wiles tried to kind of just fix it quickly before the news got out, because this was the story of the century, and it was turning into the embarrassment of the century. And the reason I mention this is because, and there's this lovely line by the Dutch mathematician Piet Hein, I think, where he says, a problem worthy of attack proves its worth by fighting back. And that's what Fermat was doing, was fighting back one last time. But eventually it became clear there was a problem because no paper had been published, and every other mathematician was then trying to fill the gap, because if they could fill the gap, they would have proven Fermat's Last Theorem. But Andrew Wiles invited one of his former PhD students, Sir Richard Taylor, to come and join him in Princeton. And they collaborated on this. And again, having people work on ideas together, bouncing ideas off each other, it leads to richer...
Yeah, and that was actually, that resulted in two papers.
One yes.
was a joint between the two of them, and then Wiles is...
Exactly, yeah. So, I just wanted to correct the idea that even Wiles' story, the most extreme story of solo genius effort, it did have collaboration there as well.
Even as an outlier story, actually other people were involved, and I think that's quite an interesting one. And so there's a kind of another element here... Going to pick on your last book, which was The Simpsons and Their Mathematical Secrets. The revelation that actually the Simpsons scriptwriters are mostly math nerds, and they're collaborating in a way that is very similar.
I wouldn't say most of them are mathematicians. I would say that if you look at the different populations of writers, the biggest population are the mathematicians, and these are people who have... PhDs in maths. Jeff Westbrook was a professor at Yale. J. Stuart Burns was doing a PhD and abandoned it in order to join the Simpsons writing team. Ken Keeler has a PhD in applied maths from Harvard. Lots and lots of these mathematicians, serious heavyweight mathematicians. And I got to meet them. I got to spend a week with them, going to some of their script meetings and readings of the scripts and some of the editing suites, and got to really spend a lot of time talking to them. And I asked them all, why are there so many mathematicians here? And they gave several reasons, but one of them was writing comedy is intellectually really difficult, and having a background in mathematics means that you know how to tackle difficult problems, and you have the intellectual stamina to kind of get through a comedy script and intuition as well. You know, again, you mentioned the idea of creativity in maths. You know, you have to have that intuition of knowing where the answer might be, and then the stamina to pursue that. And similarly, in comedy, you need to know where the funny is. You know, where might that joke be? But also, they all said, it's a collaborative thing. You know, we worked on math problems together when we were at university, when we were at college, and we work on comedy scripts together. And, you know, somebody comes up with an idea and you add to it and you build to it. And it's a lot of them felt it was the same as doing maths together.
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Now in its fifth season, Inspiring Tech Leaders is the podcast that talks about technology strategies, challenges, and breakthroughs shaping today's digital world. Each week, Inspiring Tech Leaders brings you technology reviews and interviews with visionary CIOs, CTOs, and industry pioneers. Whether you're leading a tech team or just love innovation, Inspiring Tech Leaders is your go-to source for inspiration and real-world advice. Subscribe now on your favorite podcast platform.
Now, a lot of what you produce individually, and but also in collaboration, seeing videos of Matt Parker and certainly everything you've done with Adam Rutherford, there's a great deal of humour. I don't think you go out to be, you're not doing stand-up.
No.
But there is an immense amount of humour. It's incredibly engaging. I think for a lot of people, they're kind of drawn to that. It's just like, hey, guess what? Science, math, it's all fun. This is enjoyable. You're allowed to do this. You're allowed to not be po-faced and all the rest of it. So is that something that you notice in your work style? Is that something that is general? Is it something you notice in other mathematicians? Or are we seeing a landscape which is much drier than the one that we've been offered?
Oh, I don't know, really. I just think it's quite hard not to find some of this stuff quite funny. Like, I don't know, for example, Adam and I were thinking very deeply about sort of the scientific method and what it means to have to like accept failure and to like recognize that you're wrong. And I was like, oh, I remember there's a brilliant story about this that we can put in the book. And it was Christopher Columbus, who was famously not a nice man, but sort of built his whole legacy on the world being round, right? He was also, by the way, absolutely terrible at sums, right? Really bad at it. So on one of his voyages over to the Americas, he got his maths wrong and miscalculated where the North Star was in the sky and had it like it was jumping around all over the place. I mean, it wasn't. He just couldn't handle an equation. So he looked at his charts and he was like, well, this doesn't make any sense. So he decided to come to the only possible conclusion that he thought was rational at the time, which was that there was no way the world could be round, right? There was no way his sums could be wrong. There was therefore no way the world could be round. So he wrote a letter to the King of Spain and he says, I have reached the conclusion, my entire life's work, everything I've built everything on, actually, it was all wrong. And the world is not round after all. It is shaped like a pear. And at the end of the pear, where the stalk would be, is something akin to a woman's nipple. And my favourite bit, sailing up the nipple means you're sailing closer to heaven, right? Now, here's the thing about that. How can you not find that funny, right? I think it's impossible to be po-faced about that.
So this is centuries before Freud, and this is one of those things that sometimes in science, or the activities of misapplications of science and maths in the world, we learn more about the person who's making the mistake than we do about the mistake. I mean, you know, come on, Columbus. I mean, literally pear-shaped, but also a nipple thing going on there. Man, is there some issues? Yeah,
you got flat earthers, now you got nipple earthers.
I mean, yeah. I believe that's underrepresented in the modern kind of online conspiracy theory domain. I don't know.
To answer your question, in seriousness, though, I think that... I know that, Hardy, for example, the book that you described earlier, A Mathematician's Apology, is a very eloquent, beautiful description of what it is like to be a mathematician. And I think that there are tons and tons of people who do that and do it incredibly well. But I think for me, the main reason why I like doing this, in part, is because I think it's really important. I think actually entire society benefits from better education in science and mathematics. But mostly it's because I just find stories like that nipple story that are so ridiculous. And it's like having a secret that you want to share at the pub. Like, that is genuinely how I feel about it. And it's like, I just want to go and tell people because it's so crazy. So I think if that comes across as like irreverent or, I don't know, tongue-in-cheek or whatever it is, then I think it's just because that's the way that I see them.
I think that's great because, I mean, again, this is a wonderful human connection thing. It's just like, here's this here's this kind of like huge mountain of intellectual stuff, and isn't that funny?
Yeah, of course.
And that's a bit of a laugh. And, oh my goodness, when I had this idea, and it's just like, yeah, there's sort of a joy there, which I think
scientists and mathematicians aren't these grand figures, right? They're like, they do stupid stuff. They make stupid mistakes. They're just totally normal people who happen to really like maths and science. And I think pretending otherwise actually isn't that helpful.
Yeah, I think that's very true. Now, somehow I need to segue from that into the question. Have you been asking questions? Okay, excellent. Right. Okay, so we've got some... actually, this is pretty good. Okay, so what is your favourite number? Let's start nice and easy. This is going to warm you up, okay? What is your favourite number?
Just trying to check it doesn't relate to any of my PIN codes or anything.
yes. Oh, and the name of your first dog. And yeah.
So 26 used to be, and I remember, so this is genuine, I think. I'm not a mathematician, so I started, and I used to think, you know, math is something you learn about in order to do physics, and it's quite useful, it's sometimes interesting, but physics is the real thing, okay? And I still love physics. But then I made a documentary about Fermat's Last Theorem and I started writing a book about it. And I remember learning that 26 is the only positive whole number that's sandwiched between a square number and a cube number. It's between 25 and 27. And that's kind of remarkable because in the infinity of numbers, that's the only time that happens. And it's kind of remarkable because we can prove it. And the proof is not so difficult. And it was one of the first proofs I went through that wasn't trivial, but wasn't so hard that I couldn't follow it. And so that was a kind of just, that was a really interesting moment for me. It was a moment which I realized that this is going to be an exciting book for me to write because I'm going to learn some cool stuff along the way.
Right. Yeah, no, that's a good case made for 26. Mm.
Okay, I'm going to tell you what my number is, but I can't remember the actual number, but bear with me.
Now, I do remember you've spoken at computing conferences and you do code. So classic coding response.
I just need to look it up on Google. I know Okay, but I'll tell you what it is, right? So the thing is that there are pure mathematicians and number theorists who really love numbers, right? And I fully respect all of that, but it's just not my bag, right? I don't have a relationship with numbers in the same way that other people do. I much prefer human stories, and so for that reason, the number that I like the most is Ramanujan's number. So you see what I can't remember what the actual number is.
1729.
It is 29. Okay, I thought it was 92. Okay, fine. 1792.
29.
Forgive me. 1729. Okay, so basically, there was this mathematician called Ramanujan. He was the character on which the film Good Will Hunting was based. He was born in India in a very small village, self-taught, unbelievable in terms of his intellect, right? I mean, I think it's fair to say there have been only ever a handful of people who have ever existed who were in his league. He wrote letters to Hardy while Hardy was at Cambridge. And Hardy, there's one story about Hardy seeing these letters and thinking, Ramanujan made up all of his own notation, right? So he didn't know the exact way to write sine and cos and all of that. So he made up his own notation. And he wrote these letters to Hardy saying, I've come up with this mathematical thing. And Hardy looked at it and was like, well, this is an absolute load of gibberish, and sort of put it in a drawer and forgot about it. And then a few months later, Hardy was in a tutorial or a lecture at Cambridge, and somebody was writing something on the blackboard. And he was like, hang on a second, I've seen this idea before, and went back through and realized that actually Ramanujan was doing this work on his own. I mean, it's incredible. So the Ramanujan number is, Ramanujan, very tragically, he was brought over to the UK, worked in Cambridge, and he just didn't suit the weather at all and got very sick. All of the viruses that were in the UK, not the same as those he'd grown up with. So he got very sick and very tragically died very young. And while he was laying in bed in hospital, I think it was Hardy that went to go and see him, wasn't it? Hardy went to go and see him. And Hardy, who's like a very British gentleman, didn't really do that well with emotion, sat by his bedside and didn't really know what to say. This desperate tragedy of his mind that was about to pass. And so he decided, okay, The taxi cab that I got here, just trying to make conversation. The taxi cab that I got here had a very uninteresting number. It was 1,729. And Ramanujan, who is literally on his deathbed, said, "What do you mean it's not an interesting number? It's the first number that cannot be written as the sum of two cubes or something."
It can be the smallest
number that can be written as the sum of two cubes.
In two different ways.
I told you I don't have that relationship with numbers. The human story I've got.
Yeah.
But it just really, really, I think, underlines how extraordinary he was and just how much Hardy, one of the greatest mathematicians of all time, revered him. And that story is the thing that he told after his death.
Those are known as taxicab numbers as a result. What's interesting is you're talking about the relationship with numbers, and it was John Littlewood that said that Ramanujan has every one of the positive integers is one of his personal friends. Mm. You know, it's just like, you know, you'd be able to tell you everything about it. It's a deep intuition. It is incredibly rare. So yeah, that's a good number.
I should probably remember it for next time somebody asks me that question, don't I?
Well, I'm just throwing my favourite number here, 37, because it's colour-coded. Okay. I was talking to her about this earlier. Synesthesia, 37 is really good because it's got a strong yellow with a blue. We can have that conversation later. And 1729 actually has a very specific colour. So, yeah, that's why I remember it, as long as I'm a math whiz.
A specific colour for you or for synesthesia in general?
I know, probably for me. Oh, right. My youngest son is also, he has colour grapheme synesthesia. We do not agree on colours.
Right.
And, you know, he's it's just like, "Dad, that's wrong." You know, and we don't agree on the colours of seasons and words and the colour of his name and stuff like that. Anyway, that's a very, just by the way, to talk about the fact that you can have a very personal experience that is unshareable. Mm. But speaking of sharing, there is, on the topic of randomness, did Hannah's bucket of numbers only contain twos? I'm not going to spill the beans on this.
I cannot believe that you guys don't believe in probability. That's you need to update your priors. That's all I'm saying.
Yeah. In fact, speaking of priors, within 5 minutes, 5 minutes walk of here is the cemetery where Bayes, as in Bayes' theorem, is buried. And this was shown to me by somebody at a conference a couple of years back. And we were walking through the cemetery and she was saying, oh, yeah, it's somewhere around here. We couldn't quite establish. And she said, eventually, it's this one probably. which was just like, somehow that seemed to make the day. So what's your favourite way to cook eggs? Let's go for a little bit of something a little bit lighter here. This is a human interest story. We don't have to mathematize.
It's a microwave.
Microwave?
Okay, that's pretty...
Simon's thing, I respected you.
Oh, that past tense is so stinging. you drove me into maths and now you're exploding eggs in microwaves. That's a good physics answer, though.
Yeah.
That's good.
Obviously poached is the right answer.
What did you say?
Okay.
Poached. Poached, right.
Okay, well, yeah, that's not the full answer. Are we going for, is it runny or is it... Is it bullet?
I mean, anything that's not in a microwave, to be honest.
okay, right. The not microwaved egg. Right, okay, yeah. So there we go. Yeah, so that defines the whole set of everything. This is non-trivial. Is maths invented or is it part of nature? We've never heard that one before. Yeah. And I don't know if we had enough drink for that, but short answers...
I'll give it a go. I mean, I did a three-part series on this. So
you did? How I know it's not short.
If you want to properly dig into it, you can go look at that. But I think that actually most mathematicians agree that there are certain aspects of mathematics which is constructed and created, right? Like what a plus sign looks like, or, I don't know, like the particular type of notation that you use for something. But the thing is that once you go off and you start to explore the relationship between things like numbers, like 26, for example, or even deeper, more topological ideas, there is no doubt in your mind when you're doing this that someone has been there before you. And I don't mean someone in a sort of, you know, mystical sense. There is no doubt in your mind that when you're exploring these ideas, that you are voyaging on a landscape that exists before humans got there, right? And there is, no mathematician that you speak to will say anything else. And so I think that it's really a combination, but mostly discovered.
So that's very much the way you're describing it, exploring and revealing. It's a revelation.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, you're revealing what is there, but we've not accessed.
I mean, I think it's also certainly true that if you had some alien species who were using different notation, who were using different ways to represent relationships between things, it might be that some of the stuff that we find really hard, right, like the Riemann hypothesis or whatever, actually they'd find that really easy, and things that we find really easy, like quadratics, say, would be incredibly difficult. I think that you're driven to discovering a certain landscape by the notation that you've chosen. Yeah. But I mean, I don't think anybody who's experienced exploring high-level mathematics would say anything other than that you are really discovering.
Yeah. So I think that Richard Feynman actually had a really nice observation on notation. He said, do not laugh at them. You know, invent them because they're powerful. It changes the way you look at a problem.
Yeah, I agree with that.
The journey that you might take.
Oh, you've just had an answer from a very clever lady who's made a three-part series on this. You don't want to ask a guy who cooks his eggs in a microwave. It's not going to end well.
Actually, you're right, Simon. Yeah, you're right. You're quite right. I mean, honestly, this is not. You know, this is a character defense or a character assassination. Actually, I think the eggs defense. Yeah. And if you want more details, I believe there's a three-part series that covers this. So what's your favourite mathematical object? And I don't know if that's one for the category theorists, but what's your favourite mathematical object?
Gosh, I'm not sure.
I don't really have like a... honestly, people must rank stuff way more than I do. They keep like a running list.
So there's something called the Collatz conjecture.
Yeah.
I don't know if people have come across the Collatz conjecture, but this is the idea of you... Take any number, let's say five. It's odd, so I'm going to triple it and add one. 3, 5, 15, add 1, 16. It's even, so I halve it, I get to 8, halve it, get to 4, halve it, get to 2, halve it, get to 1. Okay? Let's pick another number like 10. That goes to 5 straight away. Okay. The idea is any number you pick, if you follow this path, if it's odd, triple it, add one. If it's even, halve it. If you keep doing that, you always seem to get back to one. It's sometimes called the hailstone conjecture, because I think hailstones are made by, they get lofted up into the air by thermals, and then they grow and fall down, and then they get lofted up again. And that's what sometimes happens with these numbers. They loop up, and then they fall down. But they always come back down to one. But nobody's ever proven it. And what I love about that is, so I've got two sons who are 11 and 6, and it's one of the earliest ideas that you can teach to kids and say, look, here's a question. Look, you can do the math. You can do multiplication by 3. You can halve things and you can test it out. But can you ever prove it? And so I have very fond memories of that, because it was a nice way of introducing my older son to maths and him understanding that there's some really interesting questions out there. And even with simple, basic operations, you can explore and nobody has solved, nobody's got near proving the Collatz conjecture.
There's a really nice video actually by Veritasium on the Collatz conjecture that came out about a month ago. It's lovely.
Okay. But you're going with the whole fact that, clearly people
have ordered
lists.
I probably should. I mean, there's loads of good ones in there.
You can hedge. I mean, I'm going to say this used to be my technique. Just like my wife always used to say, what's your top this? What's your top five that? This used to be the thing. I used to hedge horribly. If she asked me for top 5, I'd give her top 10. if she asked for top 3, I'd give her the top 5. Somebody recently asked me, Kevlin, you were talking about films when we did that workshop. What's your top 3 science fiction films? I gave him 10. Because what you do is you give people the discussion. You say, I'd also consider this. You never actually give them the answer. Again, career advice. I was asked once for my 5 favourite books. The editor sent back, I see what you've done there. You've named 30 books. That's the alternative approach. Don't settle on one. So, yeah. Tinder for math. Yes, there's. Okay, there are software developers in the room. Get on it. That's an interesting one. Okay, this is a career related one. Is communicating science harder than doing it?
Oh wow, that's such a good question.
Why?
I think it depends who you are.
Yeah, I think there's a big push that scientists, in the broader sense of the word, should go out and talk about
their work. And I don't think they need to. The scientists are there to do science, and that's what they should get on with, and they should do it. And they should do it the best they can, and they should love it and enjoy it. But if you happen to be one of those people that love science and can talk and can enjoy, then by all means, go out and spend your time doing that. So in a way, I'd almost rather have fewer people doing it, but doing it better.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, things have changed in the last 10 or 15, 20 years. And we have, you know, a group of people who do an outstanding job in different media. And it just depends what people find easy. Some people, like Adam, finds it easy to get up on a stage and just improvise. You know? Other scientists would find that incredibly difficult. So, yeah, it's horses for courses. And I think the lucky thing is we've got a lot of people who can do it well. Yeah. So there's no obligation on other scientists to do it. They can do what they love.
I think I agree with that. I think I'd add that the one thing that has changed in the last maybe decade in trying to get people to talk to the public, trying to get scientists to talk to the public more, which is, you know, as Simon says, some people just are not particularly good at it, is that there was an old attitude that I think was really problematic. And I think it's best encapsulated by, there was a professor who taught me as an undergrad, and he had a phrase which was, "The world fears mathematicians, let's keep it that way." It's like, I think, extraordinarily close-minded and gatekeepery. Mm. And I think that when you have that attitude, not only are you refusing to share this gigantically important body of knowledge, right, like the limit of human knowledge, I also think that actually it really does end up meaning that you don't attract other people into your subject who don't see that there's a place for them in there. Mm. And I think that stepping outside is really important.
So you brought... I'm going to say Laverne and Shirley show, but not the Laverne and Shirley show, the Lauren Laverne show this morning.
Yeah.
And
talking about your book, actually.
Oh, really? Yeah. I missed that bit.
I was.
Okay. but that's amazing. On a radio show for the general public, 10 o'clock in the morning, and you're a regular.
Every week.
Every week. So that's fantastic. That's amazing. And the fact that Life Scientific is on there pretty much every week. And the fact they're in Numberphile, and the Numberphile gets 500 million downloads. Mm. It's amazing. Mm. And, you know, we don't quite have... When I grew up, I used to have Tomorrow's World every Thursday night in between Terry and June and Top of the Pops.
Oh, God.
And you used to get QED, and you used to get Horizon on every week. And what was the one on ITV with Miriam Stoppard and Magnus Pike?
Oh, yeah.
ITV did it, and Channel 4 had it. And then there's less TV, less science on mainstream primetime TV, but it's everywhere else. And, you know, Lauren Laverne is, you know, mainstream primetime radio. It's fantastic that we've got people out there doing it. And it's great.
Okay.
So. And also, I mean, Ben Goldacre said something which was very good, which is we often say, you know, we want more science in the news. You know, the more science it's covered in the press, the better. And Ben Goldacre once said, you know, actually, we don't necessarily want more science, because the more science that gets in there, it tends to be a bit spurious, a bit sensationalist, a bit, some odd study there that's got some curious result that's going to make a headline. What you want is sometimes a bit less science in the news, but you want more credible science in the news. But that's a different thing from documentaries and features and radio programs. That's a news issue, I suppose.
So that somehow segues to the final question, the last question. Somehow we can make that theorem. There are loads of questions. Thank you very much. These are excellent questions. If my sense of time distortion continued, we could deal with all of them. Sadly, we are going to redock with the real world, so I'm going to leave you with one last question, which somehow seems related. What advice do you have for adults who want to rediscover the beauty of maths? Sort of a re-engagement.
I would start with Numberphile. I mean, I really just think that is the most extraordinary resource of everything from very light, chirpy, silly videos through to some very deep ideas. And I mean, there's a reason why it's got 500 million downloads, right? And why both of us have been on it. I think it's a phenomenal resource.
Yeah, I mean, the only other two things I add. So again, when I talk to sick formers, or I say, just make sure you watch Numberphile, terrific videos, but also Vi Hart, who doesn't make as many, he's not as prolific, but makes beautiful videos. And then Martin Gardner, you know, I just think, you know, I grew up reading Martin Gardner, and his stuff is still incredibly impressive and wonderful to read. And so I'd really encourage teenagers and older people that want to rediscover the love of maths, go back to Martin Gardner.
Excellent. Right. Well, I just want to thank both of you. And a big hand for our guests, please.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the GoTo Podcast. Head over to gotopia.tech to discover lots more content from the brightest minds in software development.